Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
There was a Zen teacher by the name of Hoshan. And he used to give the following sermon. To discipline ourselves in learning is called hearing. To reach a point where any more learning no more avails is called approaching. When one goes beyond these two stages, one is said to have truly transcended. And he gave this sermon frequently. And one day a little monk came to see him, and he asked, what then is truly transcending? And to this, Hoshan didn't say a word. He just to all questions of this sort, he always answered the same. Well, there are a great number of questions that have persisted, and let's say they've haunted some men throughout the ages. Questions such as, what is truth? Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? These questions have been around, I guess, as long as man has started to think. We go along in our everyday lives and we try to make a meaning. We make meaning out of what we're doing and what we're thinking and what we're feeling. But until one knows what truth is, is somehow like the meanings that we apply are slippery. You know, they're sort of out of kilter. Because they seem to answer one day, this is the meaning of my life, and the next day that doesn't apply at all. If you try to make yesterday's meaning fit today's situation, you know, yesterday's state of consciousness fit today's state of consciousness, you know, you're kind of out of step with yourself. And you create a conflict. So what is the meaning of your life? Well, this ultimate that Daruma tried to show the emperor, which we would say is the final answer, and we think of it as being down the road a piece. Remember their old song, Once Upon a Time, Celery Stalks at Midnight, Down the Road a Piece? Remember that song? You know it? You know, it was very popular at one time, Celery Stalks at Midnight. It's down the road a piece. Well, anyway, however down the road a piece it may seem, the question is also very urgent. So there should be an urgency in your asking what is truth, to know from whence life rises, and to want to know the source of life, well, and then its goal, and to know the thread of the law of existence. In Buddhism, they say the Dharma is the law of existence, the great law of existence. Well, so what is the Dharma? What is it actually? Once upon a time there was a teacher who said one should have a reference for the words one uses. Yeah. And reference in our context, is experience. See? When you experience a state, then you can talk about it if you wish. So if you're going to talk about the Dharma, find out what it is first, then you can talk about it. Because then you have a referent after you've experienced it. If not, you're just parroting. There's nothing solid in here to give the word its meaning. So this question, what is truth, is very difficult. And now if you ask this of a Christian, he might answer, well, Jesus and the angels and the principalities. He would say the Father and the Mother, the Virgin Mother, and the Holy Spirit, the Trinity. That's true. That's what they say. A Hindu might say, well, Krishna and his flute. You've seen Krishna, pictures of Krishna, little blue man with a flute, and lots of arms, beckoning, it's a song for you to come. Come, he's like the Pied Piper of heaven, or the Pied Piper of Vivekan, yeah? Or they might say something like Purusha and Prakrit. Or they might say Vishnu, Shiva, and Brahm, that Trimurti, or that Trinity. A Buddhist might say the Buddha nature. So the Buddha nature consists of the Dharmakaya, the Nirmanakaya, and the Sambhogyakaya. The Trikaya of Buddhism, which is known as the Three Baskets. And the word kaya is translated as body. So you have the body of the Buddha nature in its various states, which is difficult to comprehend except in its depth. So it is labeled that the Dharmakaya is the body of the great law, the spiritual law. And the Nirmanakaya is the body of transformation, that which transforms the spiritual state into a more material state, a gross state, grosser state. Christianity, they speak of the fall of man. So here you have a fall, as it were, of the Buddha nature through this Nirmanakaya. And then we have the Sambhogyakaya, which is the body of completeness. So it's called the body of bliss. And these are all states to be experienced. Just leaving them in your head and your interpretations of them, it doesn't really suffice if you really want to know what truth is. What is truth? That was the question that Pontius Pilate asked of Jesus, you know, when the trial was held. It almost seems as if Pontius Pilate didn't want to condemn this man that he was questioning as to what is the truth, you know. And Jesus didn't answer him. Why didn't he answer? And that's puzzled a great many people. Why didn't Jesus just come and tell him what was the truth? And the man would have let him go free. Or at least not crucified him, you know. But this man, Jesus, just stood there silent. You know. We think he could have said so much and clarified so much. You know. No answer. What is truth? No answer. Interesting, huh? You know, this Pontius Pilate, in the eyes of the world, he was an educated, successful man. He was a governor general, successful, you know. He was at the peak of his career. He had power and prestige and wealth. And always conniving to keep that position. You know, its opposite is there too, yeah. But anyway, at this trial facing him, there's Jesus, you know, almost like a hobo. You know, fanatics, they called him. And he seems almost like a failure. In the eyes of the world, what has he achieved? No power, no wealth, no prestige. He's not even respectable. So here are these two opposites facing each other. And this very successful man asks the failure, what is truth? And there is silence. Let us say, so that we can be charitable, that Pontius Pilate was greatly disturbed by this whole thing, and he wanted this man to say something so he could pardon him. Let us say that he recognized something about this failure that was not failure. That this man was something, that he represented something, that he knew something. And so here standing before him was a source of information. So he might have been very sincere in his question, what is truth? No answer. Or was his silence the answer? What would you have done? Interesting. Many centuries ago, Homer, the poet, you know, he asked the same question long before Jesus. And he answered himself. He asked, what is truth? And so truth was for him the whole. The whole is supported by fate. And fate is the truth. Well, we don't know at our point in time what Homer meant by fate. Yeah? We have our interpretation of the word. You know, our present day usage, you know, which is like fate is destiny. Fate is the principal cause by which things are supposed to come to be, or why events happen as they do. Now, the word fate is from the Latin, the word fate that we use, from the Latin fari, which means to speak. You know, that which has been spoken. See, so it's a destiny. It is already set. And not anything you can change. It has been spoken. Well, what causes things to happen as they do? We could answer this day and age by saying to the effect, the synchronicity in the ebb and the flow of the energy patterns. Does it make you any wiser? Well, you know, it's an answer. Yeah. Well, you know, if you're really miserable and someone says to you, well, it's fate. Does that help you? It's fate. Huh? There's a lot of people that believe like this. The Lutherans are, you know, this predestination thing they have, for one thing. And they're all over the world, people believe in this manner. Labeled a little differently, but the idea is the same. I am miserable because it's my karma. It's my destiny. It's my fate. Are you any wiser? So from Homer, a couple of centuries pass by, and we come to the beginnings of philosophy in the Western world. And our philosophical way of thinking comes from the Ionians, a little island of Greece, huh? And there we find in Ionia Thales of Miletus. And it was in 575 BC that he stated that the whole, the ultimate, huh, consists of water. Now, this man accomplished a great deal, actually. For the first time, a man in the Western world tried to explain the unknowable by something known. And he saw that there was this moistness, this liquid element. It was a flow. Life flows. So he called it water. It correlated. You know, water could become a solid through freezing. It could become a mist through heat. See? But in a way, he's trying to describe this Nirmanakaya state, the transforming, you know, of things. So he conceived that all things were just simply varying forms, multiple forms of one primary and ultimate element. This is very important, huh? So he raised the question, what is the ultimate nature of the world? Big, big step. Beginning of philosophy and beginning of science. What is the ground of it all? The Urstock, they called it. The ground of it all. And then we come to Anaximander, and he also was looking for the ultimate element. But he decided that it couldn't be water, because why wasn't the whole world now by now dissolved into this water? And water is simply the opposite of something else, like earth. or like air, or like fire. It's the opposite of something. So he said that this Urstoff is an indeterminate. You couldn't determine what it was. And it's more primitive, more fundamental than any of these elemental opposites. And that it was that indeterminate out of which all of these elements came and into which they would pass away again. But this indeterminate was a substance without any limits. It was ageless, eternal, and encompassed all worlds. And then Anaximenes appears. And he said, Urstoff is air. See? Man breathes. See? Everything is kept alive by air. So air is a principle of life. And air also encompasses the whole world. Then we have the Pythagorean society. And here comes numbers and geometry, mathematics, symbols, you know, some of which this society presented is still in use today. We don't have a really good understanding of what he had in mind because it's too fragmentary. But music, which they used a lot of, is numbers. And he didn't have the word frequency, but he did use length and interval. Odd numbers, they said, are limited, and even numbers are unlimited. And somehow they came out with, if I remember correctly, that marriage is the number 5. Woman is 2. And man is 1. That only amounts to 3. But marriage is 5, according to them, to this number system. Anyway, and he was also the one that said that 1 is a point, 2 is a line, 3 is a surface, and 4 is a cube. It's a solid. And they said that this 4, this cube, represents the human body and contains all the other 3. That's still in use today. Of great importance, the Pythagorean society was its influence on Plato. And Plato, of course, influenced Christianity, more so the Eastern religion than the Aristotle influenced the Western religion, the Catholic, the Roman Catholic. But anyway, the Pythagorean society was the first to teach the heliocentric system. That this planet is not the center of the universe, but it revolves around the sun. And again, all of that revolves around what they called the great hearth of the universe, some kind of fire on the great hearth of the universe. See? And Pythagoras himself designed the Pythagorean pentacle, which is a Kabbalistic six-pointed star with an eagle at the apex and a bull and a lion under the face of a man, which symbol was adopted by both the Eastern and the Roman Christian churches, who say they represent the 4 evangelists. Euclid's first 5 books are based on the teachings of this society. Tremendous, huh? And then Anaxagoras, who said that everything is mind. Speaking about mathematics, though, back to the Pythagoras and his society, there's a little intellectual joke that they tell in there about two mathematicians having a discussion one day, you know, and one of them asked, is there any meaning in life? Is there any worth in life? Is there any purpose in life? And the other one looked at him and said, well, what else are you going to do with it? It's an end joke. Then we come to Socrates, who said the ultimate is wisdom. It's knowing. When man comes to his fulfillment, then wisdom rises. Wisdom then is the essence of man. So, you know, and all in between, the water and the air and the fire and the different things that the philosophers brought out that the ultimate could be. And to me, it's interesting, this history of philosophy. How through all the ages, you know, man has grown and matured and interpreted and adopted and adapted, and here we sit. Certainly not at the end of things. Man is still struggling to know the ultimate. And as I've said before, scientists now say they want to delve into the nature of consciousness to see if they can find the ultimate, rather than going through material things, but into consciousness itself. Interesting that, huh? And then also about, let us not forget that about 300 years before Jesus, Alexander conquered, you know, the student of Aristotle, conquered much of the known world until he came sweeping through. There were a lot of little nations and big nations and a lot of tribes. And they all had their own systems of belief. And didn't matter what your neighbor had. Here you were in yours. And they didn't pay any attention to what yours were. They had theirs. See, in one nation, God was named thus and so, and he was described as thus and so, and his name was whatever. And it usually was in direct opposition to the neighbor. Now comes Alexander, and in his conquering, he moved people around. He moved them from one nation to another, from one tribe to another. And so people began to adopt other beliefs, other gods. Of course, usually what they did was rename their own, or they added them to what they already had, you know. But anyway, The important thing there is that the traditions of Egypt and India crept into Greece because of this. It was as if, in his conquering, he sort of united, even though there were many factions and fighting, he united the whole civilized world, Western world, which had a very direct effect on the evolution of monotheism, the belief in one God. The ideas of the East and the West, you know, all these different religions were thrown into a melting pot in Greece. And a tremendous religious fervor began, and it lasted for 600 years. Now, this Alexander, some people talk about how cruel he was, but he was cruel only in his disciplining those who did not measure up in honesty. If you tried to cheat somebody else and he found out about it, but other than that, very fair, very understanding, and really a tremendous wonderment, because he was only 20 when he died. what he did with his life. We stand on so much that he did. Yeah? Anyway, a very tremendous religious ferment followed him. Egypt grew. Greece took in all kinds of things, and it set the stage for Jesus. And when he was asked, what is truth? He said, I am the truth. Somewhere else in the Bible, he didn't say it to Pontius. Yeah. Where this I am is, there is truth. See, now we have a name, I am. Ordinarily, when we watch ourselves, we're many eyes. Yeah. It's more like a crowd in here rather than one. You know, we've got a prime minister and his director of that department and director of that department and a director of that department. Real bureaucracy going on here. And then, of course, there's the mother and the father and this teacher and this friend and that friend, huh? And so one moment we're happy and the next moment we're sad. One moment we're compassionate and another moment we're closed off and belligerent, you know. One moment you can forgive anything, anybody, anything, huh? And the next, any small little thing, and you're not going to forgive them forever. No, 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 no. So is it the same eye running through the whole thing? Is it? One moment, sitting here in silence, looking so monk-like, you know, and another moment, some small thought comes whizzing by, and there you are in conflict. Where did my silence go? It's like a wheel again, you know. These many eyes are different spokes. Huh? And the wheel turns, you know. And so there's change and change and change and change. And where in all of that is the essential I? The essential I. Yeah. When Moses was up on the mountain and he saw this burning bush, you know, and he received the tablets and all, and then he said to God, but the people will not believe me without proof. It's very interesting. Something can happen to you. And there you stand, and the first thing you're knowing, but who's going to believe me without proof? What proof do I have? You know. How will I convince them that this is the truth? No. Who is God, they will ask. So please tell me your name. Please tell me who you are. And God said to Moses, just tell them that I am. I am that I am. And this is what Jesus is saying. The I am is the truth. The I am is the very ground of your being. The Urstoff, the Urgrund. Never born, never dies. So in the Gita it says, unborn and undying. And we must find this unborn, undying in ourselves. Not by thinking, not by any words, but by a very great, deep discipline. Hoshan used to give the following sermon. To discipline ourselves in learning is called hearing. Now, usually we think of ourselves as being disciplined by others, you know, by parents, by society, by a teacher, whatever. Something that comes from out there. This idea is erroneous. one disciplines oneself. If you didn't want to follow the discipline, if you didn't want to follow the instructions of your parents, or if you didn't want to follow the patterns of society, you don't. And look at the prisons, full to overflowing, didn't want to discipline. Discipline is a kind of an understanding that you have with yourself. It's a kind of surrender to yourself, not something out there. Now, surrender is such a tremendous word. And people have used it all the way along. And I surrender this, and I surrender that, and I surrender something else. I give up chocolate for Lent. I surrender, I surrender. And comes along this thing in our life, and we want to know. So we surrender ourselves to our wanting to know. Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah. There will come a time in this process when we realize how much resistance we are carrying for all of our acceptance. So subtle, and yet finally, you get right up to that pivotal point and, oh my God, I can't let this go. How are you going to let go of yourself? Anyway, Hoshan says the first step of learning is hearing. Right hearing. Right hearing is a form of concentration. We have right speech, right action, right mind, the Noble Eightfold Path. Right hearing is not one of them. But under right mind, we could put right concentration, which comes down to right hearing. Hearing is being receptive. You're open. Now, last Sunday, because of my cough, I did announce at the beginning of the lesson that if I started to cough vehemently, you were not to sit there and be embarrassed or whatever. However you felt, that she shouldn't have started anyway, or whatever. So I said, if I start to cough, you all start to sing Easter Parade. Well, it was Easter. I think it's something that all of you know, more or less. So I was told later by someone, they didn't hear a word about what I said. They were waiting and waiting and waiting for me to start coughing. And they practiced and practiced and practiced Easter Parade. That's why I didn't say anything this time. You'd all be practicing Tararabumtie or something, huh? When you are hearing, just let it fall in. Don't make plans for it. Just let it fall in. Allow it. When I first started going to Henry, maybe it was about the sixth time or so, and I used to think, my God, I wish I had a tape recorder here. No. He would talk. And he would say to me, or he said to me early on, be like a tape recorder. The tape recorder is blank. Be like a tape recorder. Take it in. Don't make commentary. Not now. It's on the recorder. Yeah. When the time comes and you want to hear it again, you plug into that certain place and here it's all replayed again. I hope you can do that with some of Henry's stuff. Yeah? One time when I arrived there, he was reminiscing about his studies with his Taoist teacher. He started when he was 18 and finished with him when he was 21. And this man is now in his 60s at that time when I was, all those years in between, say from 40 years. And here he was sitting and he was writing out from memory what that teacher had said word for word. Well, you know how it is. If I ask you 15 minutes from now or tomorrow, what did I say? Well, I don't know. People go home and they say, well, my wife or my husband said, what did Lola talk about today? Well, I don't know. Well, interesting, huh? To listen, you have to ignore your thinking. You and I cannot think in the same head. If you're very busy talking within, how can you listen? Or if you have a problem and the problem sits here and what is being said goes up against this and you haven't heard anything correctly, you know, your thoughts enclose you. And your thoughts are selective. They're associative. They're going to select what goes with them. So they will choose thoughts, words that are going by, with what you already know. Now, I hope maybe you're not here to find out what you already know. I would assume somebody is looking for something they don't know. And then when you go out, what do you got? Oh, Lola said blah, 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 dum, 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 you know, and it's your interpretations, not what I said at all, you know. Now, this right listening is silence. In Zen, you know, a monk sits for a long time before he becomes capable of listening. The Buddha used to say, somebody new would come to me, he'd say, you sit over here for a year, just sit here, learn how to sit. You don't need to do anything else, just sit. You know. And there are those, being in India, you know, but we already know how to sit. Pay no attention to that. You just sit. To reach a point where any more learning no more avails is called approaching. You can learn and you can stuff yourself, you know, with the learning until you're so stuffed that there's no room for anything more. See, learning no longer avails. Then you can begin to approach, is what Hoshan says. So you have been so silent that you can hear. So silent that the listener disappears. Approaching. You're coming home. Everything is within. Before that, everything was out there. Now everything's within. Approaching the Urgrund. Approaching the Urstuff. Approaching the truth. And then he said, when one goes beyond these two stages, hearing and approaching, one is said to have truly transcended. So one ignores the thoughts. Then you ignore the thinker. That's a little difficult. But then the thinker drops, because the thinker exists with the thoughts. That's that I. If you're gone, what is? You know, you close your eyes, and inside it's kind of dark, isn't it? Yeah. Kind of like night. And with concentration, you drop the thinking, and then you drop the thinker. It's kind of now like you're sitting on a brink of something. You know, the koan about the man that fell over the cliff and was hanging on for dear life to those two little twigs, or a little twig, and the Roshi comes by and says, you got to answer now what is in. You're on the brink, listening, concentration. The mind concentrated, huh? And little by little, this night that you're looking at, it begins to get light, huh? It's like the sun rising in the morning. You know, it gets a little lighter and a little lighter and a little lighter. All of a sudden, there's the sun, huh? There's this great source of light, a great source of energy. There isn't any within or without. There's no duality. There's no boundary. There's no limit. But this poor little monk, and he was just bewildered by this lecture, and he asks, you know, well then, what is truly transcending? And Hoshan, well, what transcends yes and no? In the Upanishads, we read that there was this teacher, Yajnavalkya, and he was asked by his student, Sakalya, you know, how many gods are there? Of course, you know, in the Hindu pantheon, lots of gods. You know, the fire is a god, and the wind is a god, and the air, and the earth, and every tree, and every bush. You know, all gods. And the teacher answers him in the words of a prayer. There are as many gods as there are in the hymn to Vishnu, the 3,300. Yes, said the student, I have heard that. But how many are there really? Thirty-three. How many? Six. Come on now. How many? Three. No, no. How many really? Two. How many? One and a half. Now, come on, huh? Really? How many? One. And the student, he stopped asking, but supposing he had continued, how many? Hoshan is saying, all duality is transcended. What then is to say? If all duality is transcended, what is to say? Language functions in duality. A man is described as being the opposite of a woman, and a woman is described as the opposite of a man. They complement each other. Matter is not mind, mind is not matter. Spirit is not body, body is not spirit. Night is not day, and day is not night. God is not the devil, and the devil is not God. I am not you, you are not me. In objective self-consciousness. Right. In language, we need the opposite to describe. A comparison is needed. The transcendental means there is no other. There is no other. It is a state of non-duality. There is no other. I am you. You are me. But how does one describe this? You can't. Transcending, we are one. There is no other. How can one describe one? There's nothing to compare it with. So how can you describe it in language? So you set the language aside and you discipline yourself in silence and you transcend the outer and you transcend the inner and then you beat the drum. Understanding, hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.